Today is Thursday, August 4th, 2022. This is part three of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Ronnie Mac McFarland. Ronnie's last name is spelled M-C-F-A-R-L-A-N-D, but he goes by Ronnie Mac. My name is Tom Martin. Good evening, Ronnie. How are you today?
Doing good, sir. How about yourself?
Very good. Thank you. Ronnie Mac, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much. At the end of our second interview, you were just getting ready to come out to the Navajo Bridge. How did you first hear about that job?
I've gotten a call from Jay Rollins, who was bridge superintendent for our division manager for Trailer Brothers. And Jay used to be with the John F. Beasley Construction Company. And when Trailer Brothers had bought the bridge division from Bill Landfair, Frank Williams, that's when Jay went to work for them. And Jay had called a good friend of mine, Rick Peters, to come out and run the phones for him, but Rick was busy on another job, and Rick had told Jay to call me, so then Jay called me, and then that's how I got involved in the bridge.
And Ronnie Mac, is that common where, you know, this is a tight-knit group of people, it sounds like. If you need somebody, you call somebody who you know that works hard and is good, and if they can't do it, they might refer to somebody else. Is that normally how that kind of works out?
Yes, a lot more than what you would think. And the guys that do, you know, the big bridges, like, you know, like Ed Kidd and Jay Rollins, Rick Peters, Bob Peters, Ed Cross, David Mash, myself, and others. You know, the guys that do the bigger, more complicated projects, you know, you keep running into the same guys. You might not see some guys for 10 years, and then you'll be on a big project, and then you'll run into them again.
Okay.
But, you know, as far as like on the bridge side, you know, usually when those guys are needing help, you know, they'll call somebody, you know, to get help. And if they're busy and can't go, and they know somebody that's still part of that group that have worked together in the past, you know, they just keep going down the list until they find somebody that can go.
Got it.
But the trouble with the really good help is they're always busy.
Yeah. Yep. Okay.
It's kind of a double-edged sword, yo. I might be working on one project and say Ed Kent needed me. Well, and if I wasn't real happy with the people I was working for, you know, you'd be more than happy to go. But then if I was happy where I was at, well, then Ed would either find somebody else or they'd offer me more money than what I was making there to get me to go over. But you have to kind of watch how you do that, because you don't want to burn too many bridges, because somewhere down the road you're going to need a job.
Right. So it sounds like kind of a tricky business.
Yeah.
Did you know, go ahead.
And I've had people, you know, that would get mad at me and be like, you'll never work for me again. And my comment's always been, until you need me again. Sure enough, you know, a year or two down the road, they're calling.
Uh-huh.
I know I said you never work for me again, but I need you.
Yeah. Interesting. When Jay got in touch with Rick, and then Rick got in touch with you, or Rick told Jay to get in touch with you, Did you know Ed Kent was going to be working on the job?
I didn't even really know anything about the job until Jay had called.
Okay.
I know I was working for DCCI like a year or so before this, Danny's Construction Company out of Shakopee, Minnesota, and I know they had bid on the project, but we wasn't a successful bidder.
Okay.
So, I usually never ask about which projects they're bidding on.
Mm-hmm.
Because they'll bid 300 jobs to get one.
Wow.
So I never worry about, you know, what they're bidding on. Just let me know what you actually have.
Okay. It sounds like it's pretty competitive. There's a lot of companies out there bidding for bridges.
Well, I mean, not so much on the bridge end, but like normal buildings. You know, that's a lot more competitive, but in the bridge market, especially the bigger, more complicated bridges, there's not that many players.
Okay. Thank you.
You know, there's like American Bridge, Trader Brothers, then you have like the Kiewitz and the Kramers and the Walshes and the general contractor side. And most of them have gotten in an order where they try to have their own erection division.
Hmm.
Because guys like Ed Kent are harder and harder to find.
Hmm. Okay.
All them old, what I call like superstar bridgemen, like Ed and Lamar Kent, Ed Cross, and those guys, well, they're all dead and gone.
Yeah.
You know, Ed Kent's nephew, Jerry Kent, he's 69. Well, he's still building bridges, but he works for American Bridge.
Okay.
Now, I mean, he worked for Beasley for years, and then whenever Beasley sold their bridge division, that's when Jerry went to work for American Bridge. He's been with them ever since.
Okay. All right. Do you remember roughly what month it was that you got that call to come on out to Navajo?
I want to say it was either in May or the first part of June.
And that's 1994.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. All right. We've talked already about what a phone operator does. But I want to get into that once you get out on the bridge and start getting going there. When you first showed up on the bridge, when you first showed up to Marble Canyon Lodge and crossed on the old bridge, I suppose, drove over there, what were your thoughts?
It's like, that's a long way to the water.
Yeah. When you got there, was there still blasting going on the Marble Canyon Lodge side of the canyon?
Well, I think they were done with most of the blasting by the time I got there.
Okay. Had they?
They were working on putting the foundation and the tiebacks and stuff in. When I first got there.
So the foundation and tiebacks on the Marble Canyon Lodge side?
Yeah.
Okay. And how far out had the Flagstaff side bridge, half bridge, I guess it's called, is that right?
Yeah. From the Flagstaff side, I think they were 3 panel points out when I got there.
Okay.
And what I mean by panel point is for every plumb post. So if you look at a picture, you got the first plumb post is right at the abutment in the shoes. and you go out about 30 feet, but then there's a vertical plumb pole. So they was at the third, working on the third or the fourth. I think I finished the third set, and then we continued on there. So there's out three paddle points whenever I got there.
Okay. Can you recall for me and recount your typical day? What time did you get up? Where'd you eat breakfast? Where were you living? What was your commute like? Who'd you report to when you got to work? And what was your day like on the bridge?
Well, I mean, I always got up early, so I probably got up at 4. Fixed me a lunch. Don't eat breakfast.
Okay.
We were staying in Page. Me and Greg Reese, who was our engineer, me and him were living in a trailer house together.
Okay.
And then 1 week I would drive, and then the next week he would drive. So we'd leave Page. You'd have to drive, like, back toward Flagstaff to Bitter Springs. And then turn and then backtrack back up to Marble Canyon to get to the bridge.
Okay, were there...
Across the bridge, and there was a small office-type building to the west side of the lodge. And I forget, it seemed like there was an insurance company in there and something else. But anyway, Trader Brothers had a section of that rented, and that's where the office was at, and that's where we would meet at.
Okay.
Every morning. Get ice water and all that made up and ready, so when we left and went back out to the bridge, we'd have all that with us.
Okay.
And on the normal day, I mean, you just pick up wherever you left off the day before, and we tried to get it to where we had the traveler moved out and ready, so we just start erecting the next panel point first thing that morning. So first item of business would be to set the two bottom cord members. So you'd set, say, a bottom cord on the upstream side, and then put the diagonal in that would help hold that bottom cord up. You go the other side, put that bottom cord in and get it made up and put that diagonal in. And then once you had those set, then you'd put the net beam in out at the end of the bottom cord you just set, and then pull the net up to where you had the net underneath you. Then we would put the bottom cord star bracing in. And then we would stand the two plumb posts up out at the end of the girders that we had just set. And they had some bracing in them. We would get it set and then go up and do the top cords and then the floor beams. Move track beams out. Get ready to move traveler head. Once the traveler was moved out, then if we had time left in the day, we'd reach back behind us, and everywhere the bolt-up crew had tightened the points up, we would jump those floats out that we worked off of to have them ready for the next day. So we just keep, you know, putting floats on the pieces that we were setting so we'd have something to work off of. And then we'd leave the floats hanging there for the bolt-up crew. And when they was finished, then we would reach back behind and jump all the floats in, back out. So we just keep recycling them.
Okay, I got a ton of questions. We need to go way back to... So you were living in Page in a trailer, and you would share the commute out with Greg. Were there people living there at the job site, were there people living there at Marble Canyon Lodge?
No, Ed Kent stayed there at the lodge.
Okay.
Ed Cross had an RV that he had parked west of the lodge, maybe a mile or two from somebody he had met there or whatever. But anyway, Ed had his RV parked up there.
Okay.
Me and Greg stayed in a trailer there in Page. And then David Mash had a trailer rented there in Page, or a house. I don't remember which one it was, but because once his kids were out of school, his wife and kids come out and spent the summer there.
Right. He said he rented a house that summer for the family. Said they just spent every day swimming out there in Lake Powell.
Yep.
And great time doing that. Do you remember anybody just living out there right there at the?
But there was a lot of the Navajo guys that worked there. About all of them had a camper on their truck.
Ah.
And they would just like park out on the canyon rim and spend the night. So like after work, they would drive down by Lee's Ferry, and there was a place down there they could take a shower.
Oh, yeah.
They'd take a shower and clean up and then go to the lodge and eat or whatever. And then they'd just drive across the canyon over there. You know, there would be, you know, 7, 8, 10 pickups lined up for those guys that spend the night there. You know, then they'd come to work the next day, then that's kind of the deal. And we was only working 4 10-hour days to allow the trucking company time to keep up with having to truck everything from Evansville, Indiana, there to Marble Canyon.
Okay.
So then Thursday night after work, all the Navajo guys would go back home, you know, to wherever they lived at. You know, some of them was down by Tuba City, and some of them were down by Winslow or Gallup or, you know, Flagstaff or wherever they lived at, and they'd just go back home.
Mm-hmm.
And then show back up Monday morning.
Okay. Yeah, so you got a nice 3-day weekend there. Take off Thursday evening, try to get home, and then come back on Monday morning early. Yeah.
And a lot of times what I would do is, like Thursday after work, a lot of times I would just drive myself that day, and then after work I would either usually head back like toward the north rim, like towards Fredona, come up through Kanab, Hurricane, Cedar City. I'd come back up this way, kind of like St. Georgia, where I'm at now. I even drive down to Mesquite, spend the night, you know, just to kind of have something to do and kind of get away from Page, because you're just pretty limited to what you could do in Page.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I wouldn't do it every weekend, but probably about like every other weekend, I'd either run to Mesquite or I'd run to Vegas, or I like to go up to like Cedar City. They had a pretty nice Western store. And I'd drive out west of Cedar City. There's big alfalfa farms, and I'd drive out there and just smell the fresh cut hay.
Nice.
Do something like that just to break the monotony, because it gets hot in Page, and that trailer that me and Greg was living in, you know, they didn't have air conditioning. All it had was a swamp cooler, so it'd usually be about 10 o'clock at night before it actually cooled down enough you can kind of stand to be in it. So that's usually why on the weekends I'd go somewhere where they had conditioned air.
Okay. Okay. And then do you remember the names of, well, let's go through just all the names of people you remember working on that job. There's Ed Kent, you mentioned him. Greg Reese, you mentioned Greg. David Mesh, mentioned David. Who else was out there?
Ed Cross.
What was Ed's job?
Ed was in charge of the boat upgrade.
Okay. So was he the bolt-up crew foreman?
Yeah.
All right. And who was working for him?
I don't remember a lot. I remember George Whitehair worked for him. But a lot of the other guys that worked for Ed, I wasn't around them very much, so I didn't remember, you know, very many of his names, and that's been 30 years ago.
Sure.
But I remember George Whitehair.
What do you remember about George?
Mainly just the name.
Okay.
He was kind of he was a man of stature between the Navajo people. Not to say he was like a medicine man or a holy man, but he was a looked up to elder with the Navajo people.
Okay.
And I'm not really sure, you know, what his official status was, but he was a man of importance among his people, and he's a good iron worker.
Nice.
I know Ed Cross was, you know, if they had a hard point that the other guys were having a hard time on, you know, Ed Cross would always be like, all right, don't worry about it. I'll send George. He'll take care of it.
Hmm. And who else was out there?
Well, Mike Charlie. Louis Begay. We had another guy that worked with us, but I can't remember his name to save my life.
Okay.
And I don't remember if he was a Begay or a Chi or, you know, but Begay's a pretty common name among the Navajos.
Mm-hmm.
But he lived in Tuba City.
Okay.
And he was kind of a cowboy type. And I don't remember if he roped or if he had roped broncs or bulls, but, you know, he was a... He was a cowboy.
Okay.
An Indian cowboy kind of made him the best of both worlds. He could play cowboys and Indians by himself.
Was there a lot of joking going on the job?
Oh yeah, of course, you know, most of them guys didn't know me when I first got there because they'd never been around me. So you'd have a lot of wide-eyed jokes and, you know, a lot of, what are you doing on my reservation? Of course, you know, I mean, I wouldn't take no shit off of none of them. I'd just be coming back here and say, well, somebody had to come out here and keep an eye on y'all.
Uh-huh. So lots of good-natured kind of fun.
And then once, you know, we got to working together, got along, and I'd pick at him. It's like, I'm the only white-eyed Indian out here.
Nice. And so Louis Begay and Mike Charlie and you were on the erection team then.
Yes, sir.
You're the phone guy. You know, I've seen in pictures there's some sort of small handheld, looks like a hydraulic tool. And I wondered if it was used to kind of spread some of the flanges to help things kind of fit together. I haven't a clue what this thing is.
I'd use a quarter power, but most of the time, the only thing we used a quarter power for would be when you'd hang the bottom cord, and you'd bolt the splice up and tighten the bolts, the bottom cords were so heavy that when you'd cut them loose from the crane, I mean, they would drop down about a foot out at the end.
Okay.
Just from the weight of the girder.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we'd go to hang the diagonal in there, I'd be out on the bottom cord. The diagonal would come around, and I'd help guide it to the guys up at the top cord where the diagonal would fit in between the splice plates, and I'd let them get it made, and they'd get a couple of bolts and a couple of pins. But then I'd take a long ram quarter power, set on the bottom cord, and come up and catch the web of that diagonal to hold it at height, and then I would climb up the diagonal, cut it loose, cut the rigging loose, and I'd slide back down the diagonal, move the crane down to the end of the bottom cord, and I'd shackle it into the plumb post splice plates, and then I'd tell the operator to start getting up on the load, and as he would pick the bottom cord up, I would come off on the quarter power to let the diagonal come down as the bottom cord was coming up until the hose lined up, and then I'd shove two pins in there real fast, and then give me a couple of bolts in my pin stroke, then I'd cut the crane loose, send it over, you know, to the other side, and you know, back around to the work platform so you hook on to the next piece. A lot of what you probably seen with the hose or whatever was probably the air impacts that we used to tighten the bolts with.
Right. This looked different. This was some sort of a tool. It looked like a foot or a foot and a half long, maybe 4 inches in diameter. I'll send you a photo if I see it.
That was probably a quarter power pump.
Okay. What would you do with that?
That's what worked the quarter power jack.
Okay.
You pump it and it would make the ram and the jack come out, and it has a little hand valve on it up at the end by the where the pump is at.
Mm-hmm.
You could tighten or bleed it off, and that would make the jack go up and down.
Got it. Okay. And while you're doing this, while you're putting out and again, help me with the terminology here. You put out the bottom cord, and then the diagonal. That stuff's not going to want to fit together super well because it's kind of hanging in space. So you'd use the crane to kind of pull it up to kind of get it so diagonal would come in, and then you could bolt it up at the top and out at the end of the lower cord.
Well, you could get the top fit in pretty easy because we'd have two floats hanging up there, and Mike could be on one and Louie be on the other one. And I'd get a hold of it and on the lower end, and I could guide it to him to where I could get it shoved up inside there, inside the splice place where they could spud a hole and then get a bolt and a pin. Get it started, and once they were made, then I would catch the bottom end of it with that long ram quarter power, because the bottom cord member that I'm standing on, you know, it's dropped down a foot or so lower than what it needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to use that long ram quarter power to catch the bottom of the diagonal to hold it, so I could get up there to cut it loose from the crane. And then once I cut the diagonal loose from the crane, then I'd boom the crane down to the end of the bottom cord, shackle into the splice plates for the plumb post. And as he started lifting it up, I'd come off on that quarter power to let the two meet together.
Got it.
And it sounds complicated, but it works really slick.
Okay, and so that would tie in the bottom of the diagonal with the bottom cord.
Yeah, to the end, to the to the end of the bottom cord, and that would hold it at the proper elevation.
Right, right. Once those two pieces were bolted together, it wouldn't sag down anymore. It would be up where it needed to be.
And in time you did that on both sides, you have both diagonals, both bottom cords and diagonals made. You'd have a bottom cord horizontal beam that would go in line with where the plumb post would hook up at.
Okay.
And you'd get it put in there.
And would it hook the two bottom cords together across the width of the bridge then?
Yeah.
Okay.
But we'd also, on that beam, we would also have the net hooked to it and the overhang brackets hooked to them. So it would come around all in one. You'd have the net plus that beam rigged to it, and the net would just be hanging down vertically. Once you had that beam made, then we had ropes tied to the bottom of the net up to the top at the beam level. We'd take those ropes loose and go back the panel point behind us and then pull the net up where we could hook it off to that beam. Then that gave you a net all the way, kept it netted below you as you went out.
So it sounds like when you put the bottom cord out and put the diagonal out, you didn't have a net.
No.
What were you doing for safety? Were you tied in anyway somehow?
Well, I was supposed to be, but not very often.
Okay. That's a long way down there.
Well, that's a good incentive not to fall.
Yes, sir. No kidding. So you guys would get roughly how many bolts in a joint before you moved on?
Well, if it was a cord member, say like a bottom cord or a top cord, you had to have 50% pins and 50% bolts. So you had something in every hole.
Oh, wow. Okay. So the bolt-up guys would come in and they would knock the pins out and replace those pins with bolts?
Yes.
Okay.
And the bolts that we stuck when we were hanging it, we would tighten them up before we cut loose.
Okay.
So when the bolt-up crew come by, all they had to do was knock pins out and stick bolts in the hole. Now, unlike the diagonals and the bottom cord star bracing and the secondary members, we'd usually put, say, four bolts aside in the diagonal, maybe eight bolts and three or four pins per side, and cut loose and go on, and then the bolt-up crew would take care of that whenever they come by.
Okay, so you guys would have to do, 50% pins and 50% bolts on some of the joints, but you wouldn't have to do that much on others.
Yeah.
So those guys, the bolt-up guys, would be scrambling to could be scrambling to keep up with you.
Yeah, but they had about 12 guys in the bolt-up group.
Okay. So that way they could keep up.
Because they would be paired up, you'd have like two guys per point. So you'd have two guys. So they'd be working on like six points or whatever at a time. So.
Okay. And then how many guys do you remember were on the erection crew?
David was the foreman. he had a guy that would help him hook on, and I can't remember that boy's name. He was a kind of a young Navajo guy. Then you had Andy, he was the crane operator. Then you had me running the phones, Mike and Larry and that other boy. So there was like seven of us in the erection crew counting the operator.
Okay. It's funny, when I think of phone operator, I sort of think you're sort of standing around all day talking on a radio, but you weren't doing that at all. You were moving. You were up and down and hooking things together and talking on the
I'd be right in there with them, you know, to
right.
help them get it made, show them how to hook the come-alongs up to get it pulled in there. Then once it was pulled in there, I mean, I was driving pins and stuffing bolts just like they were.
Yep. And Andy, the crane operator, he'd, what, get back to reading his book? What would he do? Because he would be moving stuff, but then there'd be a while he'd be parked for a bit.
Well, then once we got it down in there and we was working on it, I tell him, all right, we're in and made. I mean, we just got to do our normal thing. Well, then he was, you know, he'd still have to sit in the seat because he had something on the hook.
Okay.
But he could kind of relax because he'd know that nothing was going to be happening for a while.
Right.
And then when we got close to side, Andy, get ready because we're going to be cutting loose here in a minute. Well, then that give him time to, you know, get ready because he knew something was fixing to start happening.
Right. Start paying attention. Did would Andy move the crane back and pick up steel to bring it back out? How did you guys keep Andy fed with steel?
Well, we had that work platform that would run on the same tracks that the crane run on. But we would, like at the end of the day, we would take the work platform all the way back to the bank, and then we would load it with the next day's panel point worth of iron.
Okay.
Everything we needed. And then the next morning when we would go out, we'd bring that platform out with us. And we had two air tuggers rigged up that would pull it out, pull it each way.
Okay. Pull it out and then pull it back.
Yeah. So we'd get it, you know, rolled out there. So all Andy had to do was just swing around behind him and he'd get the next piece and then bring back around to us, and then we'd put it where it belonged. And then when it was time to move the crane ahead another panel point, well, we'd hook up our kind of like a jump line that would hook up out at the end of the top cord, come back to the traveler through a snatch block, go up to the low block hook through a snatch block, and the same thing on the other side. And when we cut all the stomps and everything loose, I'd have Andy just start working up on the big load. And as he tightened that cable up, it would just move the traveler ahead till we got to our next point where we was going to lock it down at. And I just told him to hold it right there, and we'd start putting all the stomps and tie downs and all that back on it. Then we'd cut that jump line loose and get it laid out of the way, and then we'd be ready to go for the next day's business.
Okay. And you would do that for every panel?
Mm-hmm. Every panel point.
Okay. Now, as you went out, the panels are getting shorter and shorter from top to bottom.
Yep.
But there's still the same number of connections.
Yep.
So it seems like you wouldn't have to take as long to go from one connection area to another, but they're still the same number. Did the speed increase as you moved out, or was it still kind of the same? Were you putting in more panels a day, or how did it go?
It would start going a little faster as you moved out because you had more vertical brace pieces at the plumb post closer to the bank because it's taller.
Okay.
So that would be, say, maybe another 10, 12 pieces.
Oh, wow.
You know, and that don't sound like a whole lot, but say it takes you 10 minutes a piece to set them. Well, that's over an hour.
Right.
So as you kept moving out, those pieces become fewer and fewer. So, you know, it would speed up. And like when we finished the Flagstaff side, brought everything back to the bank and moved over to the lodge side to start that half, the first three panel points, we'd be about 2 days apiece to set those because there's a lot of pieces in them.
Okay. Yeah, there's like two decks or two, that's not the right word, but it was almost like there was a midline of steel in there.
On the tall bays, there's like three.
Oh, okay.
And then it moved down to two. You know, then one, and then it was just the bottom cord and top cord for like the last, you know, five or six panel points.
Okay. All right.
But after we got out, one, two, three, you know, usually about the fourth panel point out, from that point on, you know, we'd do a panel point a day pretty easy. Jump all the floats ahead, come back to the bank, get all of our iron loaded back up for the next day's work, get bolts loaded on there for Ed Cross's guys. And if we still had time, a lot of times we would go back out and help the bolt up crew if they needed help.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Just to finish out the day.
Okay.
Because they had to be bolted up, you know, on the bay that we was going to move the crane to. So the crane stayed like two panel points back from where we was erecting at. But before we could move the traveler ahead, we had to be bolted up and tight in the bay that we was moving it to because of the reactions the crane had on the bridge and all that.
Makes sense. Yeah, the crane, I imagine, was pretty heavy.
Yeah, I don't remember now just how many total pounds it was, but it was probably, no, with the counterweights and the crane and the traveler and all that, we was probably up around 400,000.
Okay. All right. What else did I want to ask you? What's a float?
A float is made out of 3/4-inch thick plywood, which are 4 foot wide and 6 feet long, and they're reinforced around the edge either with 2x4s or 1x. I like using 1x because it just makes the float lighter.
Okay.
And you yep. have a And you'll have an 1.25-inch hole drilled in each corner, and you got a 1-inch hemp rope that'll go, and most of the float ropes are, say, 75 feet. But one float rope will, like, go down through a hole in the corner and then come up the opposite corner on the other side of the float. Kind of makes an X on the bottom. If you're at the bottom looking at the float, the ropes come through there and make an X. And you tie a knot in the rope on each side of the float. So if something happened and one rope come loose or whatever, you still had it wouldn't just overhaul back through and dump you off.
And what were these things? Were they laying on the steel members then? What kept them in place?
Well, the ropes, you would tie the ropes off to to the bridge.
Okay.
And so say, you got this 4x6 float, and you go to hang it, and the 6 foot wide part is running parallel with the bridge.
Okay.
Well, the two inside ropes, you would tie them at a certain level, and then the two outside ropes to the outside edge of the float, you would raise those about 6 inches higher than the front side.
Okay.
So when you climb out on the float and was working off the float, that kept you leaning in toward the bridge. So when you were swinging a beat or driving a pin or whatever, the float didn't want to flip over backwards with you and dump you off of it.
Got it.
It kind of kept you leaning back toward the bridge.
Okay.
And 6 inches was kind of about the ideal pitch.
Mm-hmm.
If you pitched it up any more than that, well, then it had you, you know, leaning too hard in. And if you tried to do it too flat, it would want to flip over backwards with you if you stepped toward the outboard edge of the float.
Right.
So you set once the outside about 6 inches higher than the inside.
Okay.
It would, when your weight was solid, that was about the right ratio to where the float wouldn't hardly move any at all with you standing on it and even swinging the beater and working.
That makes sense. Just your weight alone helps hold that thing so it keeps leaning into the bridge and doesn't flip out back. Yeah.
And then we would also take smaller ropes and tie around the float ropes back to the bridge just to keep them from wanting to swing and rock and all of that. And if both floats were hanging down below a cord, a lot of times we'd just take a short rope and tie the two floats together.
Ah, okay.
Just to keep them from moving around very much.
Was it ever windy out there?
You'd have some wind, but most of the time the wind would like come later in the day, like closer toward quitting time.
Okay.
But kind of being down in that canyon the way we was, most of the time the wind would bother the crane more than it would bother us because the boom was up there catching the wind.
Got it.
And we couldn't really notice it down where we was because the canyon walls would kind of block a lot of that wind from us.
Okay. So there were a bunch of river trips that were launching up at Lee's Ferry heading into Grand Canyon, and they would float through the job site every day. Would you guys get a couple hours for lunch to let those people run through there? How did that work out?
What we would do is we had a guy, a safety guy in a boat, and I don't even remember his name, but he had one of our radios.
Okay.
And he would stay upstream, kind of about halfway between Lee's Ferry and the bridge. And he would let us know whenever we had a canoer, a kayaker, a rafting trip, anybody coming down, he'd let us know. And we'd have to stop all work until they got past us.
Okay.
And, you know, there was a lot of times I might have a bottom cord hanging out there and we're trying to get it pulled into the splice to where we can start bolting it together.
Huh.
And we just have to go in the holding pattern until they get down past us.
And they wouldn't realize that you've got this big chunk of steel just barely hanging up there on the crane. Oh, boy. Huh.
And, you know, and like the rafting trips, well, those guys are professional. They know the river. You know, they don't have a problem. But you'd get canoers that were kind of novelists. And there was a swirl right underneath us on the lodge side.
Yep.
And those people that, you know, wasn't real experienced, we get hung up in that swirl and just be going round and around and around.
So they'd get in that eddy and they wouldn't get out of it. Huh.
And so then we had to call the guy in the safety boat, and he'd have to run down to help him get out. And then after he got him out where they was going on down the river, and then once he got back up toward his little normal perch area, then we'd go back to work.
All right. That guy down there, his name was Dick Clark.
Not the American Bandstand Dick Clark.
Same name, different guy.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, he's well known in the river community. Good guy. Okay, so then would you guys break for lunch whenever it seemed like a good time to take a break, or was there a set time for that? How did that work out?
We'd take lunch between 12 and 12:30.
Okay.
We were starting at 7, so that would be the halfway point.
Okay.
And then we'd get off at 5:30.
Okay. Did you ever drop anything?
Not that I can remember. I'm sure they probably dropped a washer or a nut or something. That most of the time the nets call them, because the nets were a two-net system. You had the normal safety net on the bottom side, and it had a debris net on the top side. So the debris net was fine meshed enough that a nut, washer, bolt, impact, you know, nothing would fall through it.
Oh. Like
if you dropped a washer, it would be because it hit a float and bounced off a float or something.
Yep. Okay. So fine mesh, like maybe a half inch hole?
Probably less than that. Probably like a quarter inch opening. I mean, it was pretty tiny.
Oh, wow. And then there's another net underneath that one?
Yeah, the normal safety net is about made out of rope, probably like as big around as your like little finger, say probably a 3/8 rope. And that's kind of woven together in a 4-inch diamond kind of shape, the way they're made.
Okay.
And the old nets years ago were all hand tied together when they make it, but the newer ones anymore have like a hard plastic piece that blocks the two ropes together.
Mm-hmm.
Where they make the X for the diamond shape.
Yeah.
But you'd have your one set of ropes running in this angle, another set of ropes running in another angle, but once you had it pulled out, they were just in a diamond kind of shape.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is it normal for netting to have these two types of mesh systems? To have the fine mesh on top of the normal safety net?
Most of that kind of come along. The mesh kind of come along, you know, later in the career. It was a job requirement on that bridge because of all the river traffic.
Okay.
On most other bridges, for it's just normal like barge traffic and you don't have that much pedestrian traffic, we'd just use like the normal safety netting. But when all the in the early 90s, when all the safety started changing and getting more strict, that's when the debris net inside the other net started becoming more commonplace.
Okay, so the first net, yeah, it's called the debris net. Got it. Okay. And these nets would hang out on some sort of cross tubing. I mean, it just sounds like it's kind of a hassle to get the thing in place there.
Well, I mean, you had outrigger beams that would clamp on to the bottom cord beam that went between the plumb post. Well, these brackets would hang down below it and can't lever out, so you had coverage out away from the cord. So, if, say, if you fell off the outside edge of a
right
bridge, you still hit in the net.
Right.
And then you'd have a cable run on each side of that beam from one end to the other for that net hooked to that cable. And then you'd pull it back to the beam behind you. And when you set the next one, you'd pull the other end of the next net up to the cable that's on that side of the beam. And the way you hook them up, you'd go pull it up in there till you had there's little snaps on the end of that net, snap off to that cable, and after you got, say, three or four or five of them kind of hooked up there, the easiest way to hook them up would be like climbing the net that you're hooking up, grab the next hook, and kind of bounce your weight like a trampoline and hang on to the cable with one hand and that net hook with the other one. You bounce it, it come up, you snap it. Well, then you just move over, grab the next one. You can run down through there and zip that thing together in just a heartbeat.
Okay.
A lot of them guys were nervous about getting over in the net.
Because?
Just because they wasn't used to doing it. 500 plus feet above the water, you know. They just wasn't sure of it. I'd always climb over in it. You know, and that, of course, I'd be fucking with them, you know. Come on. I thought Native people weren't scared of nothing. Let me show you how the white eyes do this. Boy, I'd go snapping them off in there. Mike Charlie would get in there and help me, but he's about the only one of the others. It's like, oh, that just ain't natural.
I imagine just the visual... The visuals on that, you're looking at the river many hundreds of feet below you, right through this net. That's all you got. And I'm assuming you're not roped to anything. Is that right? When you're hooking that net up, are you clipped into anything?
Well, on that job we had to be, because that's like when they really first started getting strict on the safety. So we had off the end of the crane traveler, we had a beam that kind of stuck out there, and we have what's called retractables that we would have to hook off to while we was doing that till we got the net and all that
okay
in place. And then once the netting was up, then they would kind of latch back on some of the tile, but they still monitored it pretty close.
Okay. Yeah.
Kramer safety guy would get on to Ed Kent the most. Now, Ed, you got to be tied off. Ed didn't have a partner, but he didn't want to tie off. And Ed would just be like, I've been doing this my whole life. You know, built bridges for 40 years before they ever come up with that.
Yeah, it's tough when the bridge supervisor isn't tied up, and the bolt up crew and the erection crew are looking at him walking around all over the place without a harness rope on. And they'd be like, well, and he's like, well, I've been doing this for 40 years. And they're like, yeah, okay. Interesting.
Yeah, but Ed Kent was kind of like a god among bridgemen. I mean, he'd been on so many bridges, him and his brother Lamar both, that they had forgotten more about building bridges than most people will ever know.
Huh.
And that's why it was like such an honor to work with guys like them.
David.
When they told me something, you best be listening, because they've been there, done that, they know.
Yeah.
It ain't something you can go take a college course and become an Ed Kent. I mean, that's right. Years working in the gang, then becoming a foreman, then becoming a general foreman, then becoming a superintendent. I mean, it's a process. And not everybody can do it.
Right. David Mesh had a story of Ed Kent had a rock he would sit on.
Yep.
What do you remember about that?
He had one on each side of the canyon. He would just, like when we was on the Flagstaff side, he would drive to the job, and he had a rock on the downstream side of the bridge. And he'd just go out there and stand on that rock, and he had one of our radios that he'd be monitoring us, and he'd just be watching. And a lot of times, I mean, he'd sit there, you know, sit about all day. And, you know, then you'd come back to the bank, you know, at quitting time, and he'd be up there, and, you know, if he didn't like the way somebody was doing something, he would say something to him about it, or he'd be like, yeah, it's a good day's work, guys. And then when we went over and moved everything over to the lot side and started that half of the bridge, when he had a rock over there, he just liked to sit there and watch. I mean, it's a good observation point.
Okay, so he'd just be kind of overseeing and watching everything, what was going on. Nice. Okay.
And then, say, we was working on a cord splice, and it wasn't going as fast as what Ed thought it should or whatever. He'd holler at me, he's like, what's the problem? And then I'd explain to him, we was off a little bit on the rig, and the cord's got a little bit of a roll to it. Well, I'd have to hook another come along up to compensate for the roll. I mean, and then once he knew what the problem was, well, then he understood. And then most of the time, he would never say nothing else, you know.
Okay. And he would give feedback at the end of the day.
Oh, he'd give you feedback throughout the day.
Okay.
You know, whether it be the Ed Cross or David or me or Greg Reese, if he needed a shot or something, you know, he'd tell Greg, all right, better get out here and get that shot. Of course, Greg would always be like, well, I'm trying to finish up this paperwork, and Ed would get on the phone. You hear him on the radio. You don't have that goddamn much paperwork. Get your ass out here. They had air conditioning in the office. That's what I always kid. At the end of the day, me and David Mesh and Ed Cross would always be giving Greg a hard time. Of course, Ed Kent would be chewing on his ass. I'd be like, oh, now, Ed, you know Greg is just accustomed to conditioned air. So I don't give a shit about that because I sit out there all day long watching y'all work.
And this was June into July into August. It's hot.
August, September. I mean, oh, yeah, it is the hottest part of the summer.
Would the steel get hot? Steel get too hot to touch?
If it gets the hot, my kneecaps, you know, turned brown like a brown pair of boots or shoes. Especially on the top forge, because you'd have to like get down on your hands and knees to drive the pins on the top side of that cord.
Ooh.
Well, and it was always like lunchtime or after by the time we would set the top cords.
Okay.
So that it was, you know, that iron would be, you know, 130 degrees, and you'd get down on it. I mean, oh, it just burned the fire out of it. I finally got where I went and got me a set of damn knee pads, and whenever we get to that court, I'd put them knee pads on, and the first time, them guys was like giving me a hard time. I'd be like, money well spent, guys. Then before you knew it, they all had them a pair of them that they'd just keep handy for when that iron got hot.
Yeah, I bet that would be really, knee pads would be really handy. Just for insulation. Then one question I've got for you. There were some inspectors from ADOT. I think it was ADOT, and they were inspecting the bolts to make sure they were tight enough.
Yep.
How did they do that?
Well, on a lot of bridges, especially that one, they use what's called LIWs, load indicating washers. And what that consists of is you have your regular flat washer, then you have an additional washer that's got little bitty ribs on it that's kind of this dome shape.
Hmm.
And those are designed, when you tighten that bolt up, it flattens those ribs out.
Okay.
Down flat. And they'll take a feeler gauge and feel between the head of the bolt and that load indicating washer, and if they can't get that feeler gauge in there for at least 2/3 of the way around the diameter of that washer, well, then that's considered tight enough. So that's how they would check them. Like this bridge I'm doing here, we're not using LIWs, we're using what's called turn of the nut method. And the turn of the nut method is once you have snug tied iron, depending on the length of your bolt, that nut, you have to turn that nut, say, anywhere from 1/3 of a turn to 1/2 of a turn to 2/3 of a turn. The longer the bolt, the more you have to turn the nut to get to the proper tightness.
Okay.
The whole deal on the turn of the nut method being the best one is it keeps you from over-tensioning bolts.
Hmm.
But with the LIWs, the load indicating washers, a lot of times you'll twist the bolt in two before you can get that load indicating washer to flatten out enough to where it passes inspection.
Hmm.
So I think the turn of the nut method is the best myself, but
okay.
All that comes down to the engineer of record's preference.
Okay. I mean, I in my ignorance, I would just think about a torque wrench, which I use when I'm working on my car. You know, working on some bolt somewhere, it's got a specification, and I pull on this thing, and it goes click click, and I know I'm good enough.
Now on the turn of the nut method, like I'm doing on this bridge I'm doing now, that's what we do.
Okay.
We'll tighten the required turn of the nut method, but then we come back behind with the torque wrench to make sure they're at the proper torque.
Okay. And those guys with their feeler gauges looking at the load indicator washers, would they check like every bolt, or were they just looking at 10% or 20%? How did that work?
Usually when you first start out, they'll check about every one. But they would look at every bolt.
Okay.
They might not clear gauge all of them, but if you could visually see that it was down flat, they wouldn't. But if there was a one in question, then they'd pull that feeler gauge out and check it to make sure it's a proper tightness.
And if they found one that was loose, would they just like whip out their wrenches and tighten it up, or would they call you guys back?
Just mark it and let Ed Cross know. He'd have to send somebody back to tighten it.
Okay.
be very few of them that ever have to go back for, because Ed was pretty adamant about making sure that, you know, they checked all that before they left the point to make sure that they were right.
Okay. Yeah, it seems like you would lose a lot of time if you had to go back and send somebody back there to tighten stuff up. Might as well just do it right the first time.
Oh, and I've had to send my guys back about 3 times on this one. This drives me nuts.
Huh.
No. Missed one sway frame connection. I'm like, how do you do that, guys? I mean, if you can't remember where you was at from one day to the next, I mean, you know, I said, that's bad. I said, hell, I shouldn't have to remind you every day to make sure you tighten all the bolts. I mean, that should be just like breathing. It should be automatic.
Right.
And I had the inspector yesterday found a couple spots that they didn't tighten.
Ooh. Oops.
And then my guys get messed up. You know, the workforce today ain't like the workforce it was when I started out, because I get on their ass and then they get all butt hurt and they're like, I'm tired of you chewing on my ass. And of course my comment is, well, stop doing stupid shit and I won't be chewing on your ass.
Reminds me of some of the history books I read about the Romans building their aqueducts, complaining about the construction stonemason guys not doing a good enough job. Seems like that's been going on for a long time in history.
Oh, that's just the beginning of time.
Yeah. Ronnie Mac, we have been happily yakking for well over an hour here. Maybe.
I had to make up some for last week because I petered out on you. I need to sleep more than I needed to talk about bridge building last week.
And I'm so thrilled that you took a dose, because you're building a bridge and that bridge needs to be built well, and I'd much rather have you do a good job out there than yik yak to me on the phone. Not a problem.
Well, I'm going to do a good job when I'm at work. You don't have to worry about that.
All right. Well, maybe this is a good time to put another comma here in this, because I think the next interview I want to hear all about how you finished the first side and then went over and got the second side going. Is there anything else you want to bring in that we didn't talk about on this building out the Flagstaff side?
No, I mean, it's just pretty much a repeat. You know, we went to the halfway point. Then we brought the crane and all that back to the banks where we could disassemble it. So, I mean, it's just do one half and then move to the other side. Same procedure, same drill.
Right. There's a story, though, I'm going to ask you about to start next time that you told me about already. And so we'll start out with that one.
Taking that hydro crane across that old bridge.
Don't tell me that story yet. Just a minute. Okay, well, with that, let's go ahead and wrap up part 3 here. Today is August 4th, 2022. And this will conclude part 3 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Ronnie Mac. My name is Tom Martin, and Ronnie Mac, thank you so very much.
Well, you're welcome, sir. We'll continue this next Thursday.